The following presentation, Computational and Network Challenges for Weather Modelling, was given by Alan Gaddian of the University of Leeds at Network Shop 42 in April 2014.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me here. There we are. This is the title of the talk, slightly longer than the one in the schedule. I'm representing a lot of people here. NCAS is the National Centre for Atmospheric Sciences. It's an organisation which basically is like BAS, British Antarctic Survey, except it's distributed over 11 or 12 universities. We use JANET a great deal, so we have people, all these scientists here. We're also working with some people in America, the National Centre for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, and there's also contributions from people like the Met Office in this talk, and people like Brian Lawrence at BADC. So this really is a representative talk. I'm going to focus on the project I'm looking at, which is called WISER. I have to say, it's 33 years since I was last asked to give a talk to this sort of grouping when I was at the University of Exeter. In those days, I used to have to walk down to the statistics department and log on to SRCNet or whatever it was called and type into TSO and use a Cray-1. I don't know if people ever know what Cray-1 is. Cray-1 was a very fast machine, much faster than the CDC 7600. And if I was lucky, the network worked, and I would challenge your figures that you put up 93% uptime at SWRC, because I took the opportunity, or not your figures, but the figures on there, because it was always the network was always breaking down. Was that when I went down to see it? It was always. But so the challenges continue. My challenges and demands obviously have shot up, but we're doing the same sort of problem. So, what am I doing? Weather and climate modelling takes a huge amount of computational time. We're told now that flops are free, and it's communications and networking, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to illustrate it with this project, and I'm going to talk about the next generation weather and climate codes, GUNGHO for short. I'll come on to that in a minute, why it's called that. And the US multi-prediction across scales. I was amused to see that you're trying to connect the Met Office to JANET. If you want to cause friction, just mention my name as you're trying to install the cable to Julia Slingo or anyone down, and they will start shouting. And because I'm saying the networking is absolutely atrocious, I've suggested ways they could connect with pieces of cable, and I imagine you're going to have lots of fun there, not to mention ECMWF. Anyway, I'm going to talk now about the European Centre for Meteor, Image, Weather Forecasting. For those of you who remember joining the EU, you probably don't, this was a bribe given to get the British to join the European Union. And this is what these computers are doing now. We're about here now. So it used to be the biggest sort of non-military computer, one of the biggest military non-computing centres. They're very upset. They've just bought two Cray XC6s, which are nice machines, very nice machines. Bit big, each of them a bit bigger than Archer. Provided you don't use them on Saturdays and Sundays, they work very well on Saturdays and Sundays. They work a fair bit slower. Well, that's another story I could tell you. So they've taken two delivery of these, and that's that stage there. And that's huge demand. For my project, we're using Archer, and I would like 5 to 10% of Archer for the next couple of years. That's the sort of demands I'm talking about here. So we're talking about huge amounts of computing power, and I'm going to just illustrate it with this. So this is a logarithmic scale, huge amounts of power required, and obviously they're coming for a replacement in a few years' time. And this is what it's all about, high-resolution forecasts. It's a bit worrying, these skill figures. This is the, as they come down. And of course, everyone will give you a graph which suits their computer. Essentially, the ECMWF is the best weather forecasting model in the world. UK Met Office, Japanese, NSEP. The Germans and the French are just a little bit down there. That because of the nature, which I'm going to go on to, of the problems, ensemble forecasts, so if you can't get the resolution, just run 70 jobs at the same time and perturb them, and it gives you a bit better forecast. But obviously, the ensemble forecasts don't work. So what we're saying is these are the skill, and there's a lot of ways of defining skill, is improving. If you want to look at figures of how you're improving the forecast efficiency, you'll find today that the ability to produce a seven-day forecast is really what you had when you did a five-day forecast, the same skill. There's lots of complicated ways of working the skill a few years ago, right, 15 years ago. And this graph is increasing. Alarmingly, it actually isn't getting very much better at the moment, and that's why there's lots of talk about using new models. So what's the background to this? Well, you've all been looking at the IPCC, which I think is a complete whitewash and doesn't represent the problems, but then I'm biased, as Julia Slingo would say, head of the Met Office. That is where the IPCC said there's no problem. This is the September ice field. Now, if this was your bank account, and in 1977 you had £17 million, and now you've got £3.5 million, you would realise that this is a major problem. This is where IPCC stopped and hasn't got this. So they call this the Arctic Death Spiral. So in September, there's always a minimum ice, and there's always a maximum in about February. So you can see this ice is disappearing. And I refer to this as my gin and tonic. Gin and tonic stays cold while there's a bit of ice there. But as soon as the last bit of ice goes, it increases. So the Earth system's weather is now exhibiting huge, great changes. The models they used were inadequate, in my view. And the reason they're inadequate is because they need lots more resolution. So I'm predicting that within 4 years, we're going to lose the Arctic ice. Huge problem, and it's going to have bigger problems for lots of other people. So here we are. This is what I'm doing, a channel flow here with a domain over Western Europe. So I'm hoping to go to Italy, Lake Maggiore. They've got a lovely lake there, but they've also got the Joint Research Centre where they specialise in producing the flooding modelling. So what I do, plus the 68 degrees north and south, I'm going to drive this with European Centre data, and I'm going to then put this high-resolution domain in here. My argument is you cannot get the blocking anticyclones that caused rapid ice melt in 2007 unless you've got the resolution. Climate models just don't have the resolution. They can't represent what's going on. So we're trying this challenge here. The Americans are doing a similar thing because they're trying to get the hurricane development there. So this is a huge job. I want to give you the background of why this climate is now a weather scale process, and I'm going to show you why there's problems later on. This is what we're collaborating with the Americans. The Americans are interested only in this bit. This is their channel flow, and they put high resolution bits there and high resolution bits there. They haven't got 45 degrees north to 45 degrees south, 36 kilometers, we're going for 20 to 8. And 51 levels, top of the atmosphere is 10 millibars. This is the challenge they're doing. They're using a huge computer, Yellowstone, in Wyoming to do that. And what we're doing is an international collaboration. It doesn't come out very well, but essentially you can see that if you get to 36 kilometers, you've got 18 storms in this sort of area. Here's the US, North, South America there. And when you get to 12 kilometers, you're actually getting roughly the right number of storms. So this is, it's not just a resolution problem, but resolution has an important part to play. This is another example. This is a 12, which is one should look at this curve here. This is black one here is the data, right? And this is the blue one is your 12 kilometer model, and the red one is your 36 kilometer model. You want to get these here. Why? because it's this tale that has the societal impacts. Everyone talks about the flooding in it was told in Somerset, but we had a talk from the chief scientist Ian Boyd at ECMWF not long ago, and he just closed his notes up, and he says I work for a minister who doesn't believe in global warming. Man-made global warming, and he was put there by the Prime Minister. So let's start with that contention. I think they do believe that there's climate change, and it's this tale here that we've got to get. This tale is causing all the problems. This is the tale that was within 10 centimetres of flooding the whole of Lowestoft. So people were worried about Somerset levels, deaf were worried about Lowestoft's. And I notice it's one of your switch locations, isn't it now? And it was very, very close to being completely flooded, the whole of the city. So, anyway, so what we want to do, we want to get the resolution, the capacity, and the rarity. We've got to look at these events down there. So the project, I want to do 50 years of climate studies. 5 decades. I only want about 600 days of 4,000 cores on the new Archer supercomputer. So in terms of computing, it's a huge, huge job. I want maybe 1,000 million AUs, which is approximately 1,000 million AUs. And I only want 600 terabytes of disk space. So I want to transfer over the network soon 5 to 10 terabytes a day. Okay, so I'm not particularly bothered about what computer I've got. You'll have noticed that I've got the Praise computer. I tried to get some of the ECMWF computer as well. Now, this is a challenge, but the biggest challenge is not the computing, but all the data transfer and everything. So I'm going to improve. So if this works, in 5 years' time, we'll have improved precipitation forecasts for Western Europe, better tracking of cyclones. It's these blocking anticyclones that cause all the problems, the location of them. Going to have a better prediction of that, and this is a huge effect. Central England temperatures and changes in the surface winds, and these are actually crucial, because we need these statistics to know what's going to happen. A lot of people are looking at mitigation adaptation, but the reality is the data is not there to know what is actually going to happen. So people are running climate models at low resolution, and I want to work from the opposite end, running a weather model. So these are huge computational tasks. When NCAR bought their new computer, before they even decided where to put the computer, they went to find out which state produced the cheapest electricity. They got the state that produces the cheapest electricity, and then they put the computer there. So it's now in Wyoming, which is only about a few hundred miles away. ECMWF have got the same problem, that they've got huge energy demands, and as I said to the head of ECMWF, if you move it, the Germans and the French have got special buildings built to take it. So the whole, it's a big status thing, but it's a huge challenge for infrastructure. So this is where we come along. I'm sorry if you come from Rutherford, slipped a bit here, but this... or Oxford, well, Reading's there, but anyway, it slipped a bit towards London. So anyway, I'm going to talk about this infrastructure that I use, which I think symbolises a lot of what the networks use now. So we've got the Met Office here, and they're very good. Connecting to them is always a challenge, in all sense of words. We've got this thing, which should be here, the Rutherford Appleton Lab. They were only willing to give us 600 terabytes of disk store. I really wanted a petabyte, but they promised that they might be able to improve it soon. Leeds, that's where we are. This is Jasmine North. You've got the same Jasmine there, and there's a small Jasmine in Reading as well. And there's Edinburgh, Hector. I put Hector there. It's really Archer now. So this is the infrastructure we're using here. And we've just got a light path installed, gigabit light path, which we're using a lot. So this is the structure of the network, and it becomes important when I try and show you some of the problems we're having. So this is Jasmine North. So we've got some G-nodal Panassus gear. This is really what I would call temporary workspace that we use it as. It's only about 100 terabytes. It's very fast disk, and we can do some of the data processing on there. And we use some of the data from, we transfer data to and from the main Jasmine Center, which you call the British Atmospheric Data Center, and we transfer data to and from using this structure. And so we've got a few, there's actually a few more devices than this, 48, 64 core machines, 24, there's G-nodal switch, and the Parnassus shelves. And we're all running at the moment with a standardized CentOS, and it's we've set it up so there's clients on other machines. So this is our workspace that we use at the University of Leeds. All these are crucial factors. We've got a firewall here, which causes problems, but we can understand that. Public internet. We've got the university core here. And we've got the university staff center, which is just over there. And then we've got all these G-nodal switches, the usual water supply, which I'll come on to in a minute. And this is where we are, the North Building. So we're really connecting through the university core network, and we've also got a special light path down to RAL. So this is, I don't want you to read the details here, but this is roughly what we're doing. We've got about 1.3 petabytes of storage in our environment and University of Leeds facility. In the University of Leeds, the School of the Environment is a big user. It was the biggest grant award for the whole of the environmental sciences from the National Environmental Research Council, and we're big users of the supercomputer. But obviously, we therefore have big demands on our data transfer. We've got different arrays here. I could go into these, but we're talking about 1 to 2 gigabits of data transfer. It doesn't look very much, but we have this ART1, ART2, N8, Hector, and other international sites. At the moment, if you were to look at this, this is over our light path down to Rutherford. This is about we've got 90 megabytes a second, which our guys think should be improved to 95. But at the moment, I'm quite happy with 90 megabytes a second, never mind a day. This is actually all green at the moment, I think you'll find if you look at it. So let's now look at what I have to do, because if you understand what I have to do, then you can understand some of the challenges. So first of all, we have the pre-processing. So in all weather models or climate models, this is what you do. We have the geography, we have the data to drive it, and we have the including the meteorological data. So we have all this pre-processing going on here. We tend to do this at Leeds or RAL, and we produce, it's really quite a serial type operation. So we use maybe 128 cores, 264 core machines, working continuously, and so we can produce the boundary data that we need. Then we have to transfer this to Hector, usually via RAL, because they've got the faster links, in order to run this is the main CPU. And then we've got to get the data back and do the data processing. So there's these links here, which really do provide the challenge. The challenge is, how do we get the data in and out? And there's also challenges in the computer, in the way we do the computations as well. But at the moment, we're doing 90 megabytes a second. When I was giving this talk 33 years ago to the predecessors to you, I was bemoaning the fact that the link went down to SWERC, or the SWERC was always seemed to be a problem. They had an ICL DAP machine at that time there, and that there was continual problems. And I would have been, 90 megabytes a second was completely unbelievable. We were traveling using data. I would get on the train at Exeter often with a bag of cards and wander up to Reading and have a two-hour job, run on the Cray 1 and take the data back. Or I would go down to the statistics department and connect with TSO through to the machine at Daresbury. In fact, the machine was then moved from Daresbury to Rhyl. And again, I had to go there and get collected on the train, and the throughput was better. It was not long ago that I had to produce some data from America, and the quickest way for me was to get on the plane and to hop on the plane, go over to NCAR, download the data, then hop on the plane back. That was by far, it's probably still the quickest way to get the data back. The only trouble is when you go through Frankfurt with hard disks, if you've ever done that, no one's ever done that, you get dusted down, your hard disks get dusted down, and you're a criminal. So they do not like you taking hard disks through Frankfurt. So that is still, but we're still transfer data across like that. It's now actually, interestingly, 3 or 4 years ago, it was still quicker to get a 2 terabyte disk and I'd suggested walking or getting a bicycle to ride down to Daresbury and then to Rutherford than it would be to put it over the internet. That is the Janet network, and that has now improved. So it's important. So what are our challenges? Well, the challenges are getting the data files from the US. So I'm going there next week for a conference talking about this work. And it might well be I'll be taking on Frankfurt Airport again to try and get through the system. The transfer data files from Archer and RAL, that is a real, real problem. At times, it's quicker to go from Archer to Leeds directly. Sometimes it's quicker to go from Archer to RAL to Leeds. It's been very periodic. The Hector people have been sorting out a lot of their problems with the new installations. It's much better, but they still haven't installed things like BBCP on their nodes, their login nodes, so we can do it more efficiently. We also have poor client performance and networking speeds in and around campus. They're getting better, but obviously we do it. And of course, in the background, there's a continual challenge to do the basic data CPU processing. But probably the biggest challenge for me this last year has been water. So if I can just refer you back to this little diagram here, it's this little thing here, you see. The Environment Department has a brand new building, and they decided they would put cheap washers in the taps. So you can imagine what's going to happen next. The washer breaks, it's reported. 2.5, 3 hours later, the estates come along and replace the washer, by which state the water's gone down 2 floors through all the air conditioning and completely destroyed all our Parnassus kit and everything. So there's a challenge, I've put water here, but there's an infrastructure challenge of trying to coax states departments out of the, I would say, 19th century almost, in a way, into seeing that computer rooms, computer facilities are actually very important. So I'm going to come to the conclusion. What's going to be the future here? Well, before we get to gung-ho, next generation weather and climate program. So there's a huge need for the massively parallel computers, and you can see that my first job 33 years ago was to vectorize some codes. It took me 2 years, and then a year later, Cray brought out a vectorizing compiler, so all my work was wasted. We need to get the Met Office, SDSC, and academics to work together. You can't imagine how hard that can be. That should have put that on another challenge. The one is that you have to change the physics. So we set up this thing called Next Generation Weather and Climate Program, and someone came out, they didn't like these new fancy grids, gung-ho grids they called it. And despite what you might think, gung-ho was an American colonel invented in the Second World War. Believe it or not, gung-ho means working together harmoniously. And that name has stuck for the project because getting these organizations to work together harmoniously was regarded as such a rare event that we've kept the name gung-ho. and communications and everything. So what we then created this globally uniform, next generation, highly optimized. And what's the problem? You can cover the globe with triangles. That's what the Germans did. They were the first there to produce their new American model. Cover with triangles. It doesn't work. There's a few problems. So the German government said, right, where are the results? So they stuck with triangles, and now they're going to change it to hexagons in a minute. But so they started off with that. This here, you can look at this. Can you see this? It's called a cube sphere. I think that's where we're going to go. Each little cube on this sphere. So you can see some odd points there. It's not just your eyes. Then people have talked about yin-yang grids covering the globe. And what's the problem? The problem is, you've got the problem is at the poles. At the moment, we've all got latitude, longitude grids. So that means if you've got 7 kilometres down here, you've got a 10-metre grid there. So the whole of the infrastructure for numerical weather prediction has now had to change. It's had to change to cope with the fact that we've got massively parallel computers. And in many ways, it's let the networking people and the data people off the hook a bit, because until very recently, the Met Office model could not be run at more than 500 cores. And it couldn't produce that much data. Whereas WARF, you could run, the one I'm talking about, you could run at 5,000, 10,000 cores. So the challenge is, how do you make the codes more? And you've got to completely rewrite them. So for the model there, this ECMW uses a spectral model, but the same applies. They have inverse Fourier transforms to calculate. The same problem has, what do you do at the poles with the small grids? And the challenge is, therefore, is to look at the grids and the data, and we're going to come on to that in a minute. So the grid points converge at the poles, and there's a huge computational problem. You need to improve the parameterization fields. That's a science problem. And the need, and particularly, the coarse resolution can't support these embedded reasons. So grid points at the poles really cause a huge problem for the computations, and they can. And so now we're looking at new grids, but you must make sure that we're just about to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We don't do that. So this is the challenge here. Now, this is what happens with the parallelization we get. So this was run on Archer, I think, on this project here. So if you're 256 to 1024, the speed up was 3.98, so 4 times the number of cores is pretty good. And then you've got the speed up here is about 73% from the ideal when you go to 4,000 cores. So these calculations were done on Archer, and we could get 0.71 model days. It took to do a model day, it took 0.71 days, except at the weekend. And at the weekend, that could increase to 0.8, and if you included Sunday, it would take 0.9. So your units were not going, so we've got complicated algorithms now to make sure we don't run the codes at the weekends. And you could say, what is the problem? What's going wrong at the weekends? And it's I/O and disk management. So if you do your disk management, so not only have we got network problems, but we've got disk problems and we've got network problems within the machine itself. So when I went to ECMWF, I was immediately dragged in. And they're obviously having problems as well. Our meteorological codes have not only got lots of data, but they have lots of internal data transfer. It's really a vector problem to actually do these numerical models. So this is what the US have come up with. So if you look here, you can see these fancy grid. Obviously, they're looking at... They're based in Colorado, so they've got the highest resolution here. So for model for prediction across scales, this is really a challenge. They want to run 100,000 cores, 200,000 cores, 300,000 cores, and they can do that. The problem they've got now is the data, and they use all these fancy grids, variable resolution, and in fact, it's the same dynamical core we've got in WARF. So here we've got the MPAS. We can focus in on hurricane, this region here. You'll find there's certain mostly hexagons, I think we're going to go to cube spheres, but the seven-sided cells there, and we've got some, if we go, the other option is go to hexagons, and if you looked on the hexagon one, you'll see there's nine pentagons dotted around, which cause problems and does grid imprinting. All these challenges have got to be faced. But what people are now beginning to work, they can get the solver algorithms, they have to put conservants here. But one of the biggest problems now is communications within the machine and communications and I/O out of the machine. And then when you've got that, we've got the data store. And so for all our meteorological applications, we have the I/O and the data store and the communications within the machine. The Americans have gone down this line. The British, I think, will go down the cube sphere line. But the problem then is that you immediately produce problems with data transform. So these are different domain configurations. It might look as though there's no resolution down here, but there is on the Arctic. You get around the time stepping problem. So we're beginning to face and overcome all the grid structure problems, the algorithmic structure problems, that we can now use these massively parallel computers. We should be able to use 100,000 cores. I've used 50,000 without any problem on these. Now, the problem is that how do you now start coping with the increase in I/O and the networks and hence the data in and out of the machine? When Archer closed down its RDF facility so they can move it quite recently, the backup effects and causes caused a lot of issues with communications, and a lot of people complained that they were running out of compute power because of the communications and the data. So I'm going to summarize here a little shorter. But in this talk, I've tried to provide an illustrated example of weather scale simulation. When I gave this talk 33 years ago, we were looking at a very simple model. We were looking at 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude less in computation. We're using a very nice Cray-1 computer even then, but the only way to get the data in and out was actually to go down with a deck of cards and output and draw it up. The data analysis problem is now becoming extremely large. What do you do with the data? The weather community is now adapting to these parallel algorithms. If we're talking when this gung-ho is going to come out, this gung-ho model is going to come out maybe in 10 years' time. The Met Office want to keep their leadership of most national meteorological organizations. They also want to go up to space weather. Space weather is becoming very important for them, for contingencies. And so they've now got to raise the height from 30, 40 kilometers up to 200 kilometers in height. And that brings a lot more computation and data problems. The Jasmine system, for example, is going to be extended, but it illustrates the problems we've had in getting the data to and from. I can now quite happily transfer 2 to 3 terabytes a day of data, provided things don't break down. When they do break down, it's a problem. I want to transfer 5 terabytes a day, and I think that's a sign that it's reasonably reliable, except on certain occasions which you can pick out. I've shown you a quick glance of 2 models. Now, if you're running your computer system and you want to look at the data, they all have to do is suggest you look at these major players to see what you're going to have to cope with. And the order of magnitude plus networking is going to be required for these for the scientists. So I'm going to stop at that point. Thank you for listening. Any questions?
Thanks very much, Alan. Have we got any questions? There's one in the middle there.
Hi. Hi, I'm Martin King from Ealing Hampshire West London College. I've just a question. Do you see any use for, well, you were talking about grids there, but I was thinking of a different type of grid, grid computing. You're talking about supercomputers and
That's
data
right.
centers. Have you any experience of using distributed grids to do this sort of work?
Yeah, there was a Miles Allen did a climate. The most basic one was when you had it on your screensaver and you did your climate model simulations. Everyone had that, and we were running it, and that was a form of grid. The problem you've got with a numerical model of the atmosphere, and it's very difficult to appreciate this, it's a vector problem. So what do I mean? You have, if you like to think of waves going around the atmosphere, then wave number four, so there's four loops going around the globe, is very important for blocking. So if you get these structures, then you get the small structures that are small cyclones, and then you get, if you want a blocking anticyclone, huge one of these wave number four things going around, this stays still, and it's maintained by these small things going around the outside. So if you don't get these small things going around the outside, you don't get it right. So we've got a challenge there. We've got these big structures, and we've got the little structures. So when you're trying to find out what the weather is here, or what the differential equation is solved here, it also depends on what's going on 5, 10,000 miles away as well. So the question is, it's a vector calculation. It's one that has huge amounts of communications to do it at high resolution. So if you can fit, that's why the Met Office and people always bought these huge vector machines, because it was a vector calculation. You're looking at things that influence here are maybe local influences. If you go down to Bridgewater Place, they're going to put all these fancy things in small-scale features to huge long-scale features, and therefore the communications hits it every single time. That's why these new grids are coming in as well. So you can't do it. It would be lovely to be an astrophysicist. The T3D, does anyone remember the T3D? T3D, terrible machine for us. Absolute horrendous machine for us. Astrophysicists loved it. They had bits of galaxies here, bits of galaxies there. These galaxies never talked to each other. They could do lots of calculations. We couldn't do a thing because the weather here depended on whether Colorado was like, because of similarity. So we had all these communication problems. Absolutely useless. We tried to get rid of it as quickly as possible. Sorry about that.
Any more questions for Alan? Question from me. Oh, there's one. Oh, David, right at the top.
Oh, dear.
Sure.
All right, here we are.
You're going to have to be really fit to run up there.
Thanks, Alan. You've given a really good illustration of the complexities of actually getting performance up between all of the components of these distributed systems. Now, you've got a request there that we move the networking up another order of magnitude. Barring financial issues, that's quasi-trivial on the JANET backbone. We could do that. But there's no point in us doing it unless actually everybody involved in producing or providing the environment you've just described acts coherently to deliver it, otherwise it will fail by definition. So what needs to happen to fix those coordination and human issues? Put all the technical stuff aside. We've seen other disciplines do it, but something now clearly needs to move on in weather and climate. You've mentioned the issues with the Met Office, and Shirley and I have experienced comments upon that directly when we visited. So somehow we have to get this binding better. So do you see that as an issue for within the atmosphere, weather and climate community?
Oh, yes, a big issue. It's also interesting to get different branches of SDFC talking to each other. You provide a lovely network between Daresby and RAL, but the two groups at either end have these firewalls and things that come. It's a huge challenge, and if you look at ECMWF and the Met Office, there we have a code, GRIB code, and there's 13 different types of GRIB format data. NetCDF we like because it's in the academic standard. So there's a lot of effort that's got to be made in getting these people to talk together. I'm always trying to get rid of these firewalls. I just don't like that. unplug the computer from everything else, just connect the two together. And a lot, it's a challenge of how you keep the thing secure, but you've got to get the people talking to each other. And we have a huge problem with BADC and the Met Office of getting the data to and from. That is a real, it's a real challenge to get people to agree. But I'm glad I don't have that job. My job's bad enough. But.
Well, we're happy to work with you on the details of, yeah, and with your partners.
It's going to be interesting. And of course, the power is going to be another problem: the computing power, electricity, as well as the networking.
I've got a rider.
Carry on, David.
A different question now. The issue with the poles that you mentioned, the polar singularities are an artifact of the coordinate systems.
That's right.
So is it an issue that your models, the physical, the actual computer code of your models is just tied to a legacy description of the coordinate systems that you can't get around? Because the physics is constant everywhere.
Yeah. Not quite, but yes, you're right. What you've got here is, if I was running this model in 30 years ago, I'd be quite happy doing this with the same grid point model. Because some of the people I work with moved to ECMWF, they did a Fourier analysis problem, and they solved it in Legendre space, which is fine. The only problem they've got is that when they get to smaller resolution, they have to do an inverse Legendre or inverse Fourier transform, which on a massively parallel computer will knock them for six. And that's the argument, and that's why ECMWF are trying to keep up with this. Yes, but the problem you've got is you've built up all this legacy. The physics, you don't realise how well-tuned these models are. They're incredibly well-tuned to get the best statistics out. So there's years, hundreds of man years of effort gone into parameterization schemes that you have. So what happens when you change to this? All these parameterization schemes work. The other thing that they do is, that you don't realise, is a thing called data assimilation. It's like when you do your wallpapering, you cover up the cracks, and then you keep going with the next layer of wallpaper. So every day, the data assimilation packet takes three times longer than the forecast model. So they feed the data in, they run the forecast model three times to get the assimilate the data, and then they run it again. So the data assimilation takes massive amounts of computer power and is all based on this lat-long system. So yes, it is trivial, absolutely trivial, yeah. Yeah. Would you like to come and show us how it's done?
Not for me to do.
I'm hosting a meeting here in 3 days' time with the Met Office. It's Leeds' turn to host this Gung-Ho meeting with ECMWF, the Met Office, Americans, Germans coming over. And it's all about what you do with this, what we're going to do. Working together harmoniously is the joke.
Hello. Sorry, am I allowed to ask a question? Over here?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Hi, I'm a geography student at the university. What is the maximum time that you'd be able to predict the weather forecast for?
Right. You're asking the wrong person here because I told the head of the ECMWF that he won't ever be able to do it more than 2 weeks because of what he called the upscaling process. So what have we got here? What happens here is here we've got the tropics here. So at the moment you have a large-scale weather pattern. Persistence wins every time at 10 days. Persistence, you get your best forecast. What's today? 10 days' time wins. Right? So what happens then? You have low-resolution models, so you get the transition. A grid point every 300 kilometres. That's what the climate models do. Grid point every 300 kilometres. Are you going to tell me they can predict rainfall at 5 kilometre resolution? Rubbish. They can't. They never will be able to. They don't get the tail. So what happens here is, where do all these structures, these tropical storms here, hurricanes, they come from small convective structures here, big cumulonimbus clouds here, organized structures here, squall lines here, then they make a tropical storm here. a tropical storm, then becomes a hurricane. So unless you get that cascade of energy up to the tropical storm stage, you're not going to get it, right? So 10 days is roughly the time it takes. If you take the average cyclone and depression coming through, it's got a lifetime of 10 days, so you've got to get the genesis right and the decay right, or the decay will get sort itself out. So how are you going to get more than 2 weeks' time when you haven't got the energy cascading up? So this is what I argue. That's why the ECMWF, Alan Thorpe's going for 2 kilometres resolution. So my comment is, how do you start this model with 2 kilometre resolution? I mean, there's sections of in the Indian Ocean where there's no data at all. They don't know what's going on. I was in South Georgia this time last year, and the fronts were coming through. The depressions were the wrong, low pressures were 300 miles out. They were coming through much faster, much slower. They don't have the data. They couldn't apply the data to simulation because there's no data. The biggest problem is, how do you get this, what I call, upscaling process? When you've got that, you should be able to do it. But you've also got to know what the sea surface temperature is, because that's what drives it. No hope.
I don't think there's any answer to that, is there?
I think this will be the last problem that's solved, the numerical weather prediction one, in the terms of getting that right. You're going to need much bigger computers, you're going to need much bigger networking, and huge amounts of data.
So we'll all have a job for life, then?
I think, and death as well. Because if they're going to get it wrong, they're getting it wrong now, they're not getting these right, so in 15 years' time, they're going to lose huge chunks of Bangladesh and all these sorts of things because they haven't got the models. That's what we're going to try and do. So don't put your networking things below 50 feet above mean sea level. Is my prediction, because you're going to get them. And don't put them in lower stuff. All Ian Boyd was worried about was lower stuff. He's not worried about the... Because he
knew...
So
we've got to move all the network points, then?
Yeah. Oh, you can make them underwater.
Tim's going to pretend he's Canute.
You haven't got any lower stuff, have you?
No.
Oh, it's all right then.
Thanks for that.
Fun? That's not much better. That's not much better.
Can I say thank you very much to all of our speakers this afternoon? It's been a fascinating afternoon. Excellent start to Net Workshop. Thank you all very much. And before you all disappear, just to remind you that you can go and get your birthday cake in the exhibition. After that, you're walking up to the parallel sessions, and they're up the hill, so you'll find it all signposted to you. Then it's back down in the exhibition for drinks and finger buffet. Thank you all very much.
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.